It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's a developing story of a mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. We'll keep you updated on the latest in our headlines and news breaks from National Public Radio.
First, President Obama is back from Paris, but the climate talks will continue for another week. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
Also this week, Congress is working on a funding bill just 9 days before the federal government runs out of money. Democrats have nixed Republicans' first proposal, a proposal saying it's not serious. Also, the latest polls continue to show Donald Trump in the lead among Republican candidates, Ben Carson falling well behind now. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with these climate negotiations. President was there to kick off the week. What did he say? What were his goals with this conference?
So essentially, you know, this is breaking off of the Kyoto Treaty that was passed a long time ago that the United States Congress would not sign on to. And Obama really wants to have a legally binding mechanism to ensure that worldwide we decrease our carbon emissions. And so that's what he really wants to get out of this conference, is he wants each of the countries to agree that there's going to be some legal mechanism in place. There's going to be a clear sort of guideline tracking progress and seeing and ensuring that these countries reduce their carbon output.
Now, here at home, Congress this week, by coincidence or maybe not, has, or at least the House, has taken a stab at some of his existing efforts, voting against some of what he's already done using executive authority. So what message are we seeing from Congress on this?
Yeah, they're basically saying that if you're going to ask for our approval on a treaty with regards to other countries reducing carbon emissions, you better think again. You're not going to get our approval. This was a clear message by voting against some of his executive actions, saying we want no part of this. Republicans do not care about this. In fact, if you look at the polling, there was a recent poll out today from Quinnipiac that showed 0% of Republicans thought that climate change was a top priority. 0%. Not a single respondent in the poll. Republicans want nothing to do with this at all.
So can the president commit to anything really significant in this conference without, with no hope of congressional backing on it?
This is the real tricky question. If it's thought of as a treaty, then no, he can't really back anything if they're going to make specific carbon emission deals, you know, saying this is the level of which we'd have to get behind. He's not going to get support for a treaty. However, what he's hoping is, instead of saying, okay, this is the level of which we need to reach, instead, we're going to try and put forth the mechanism that would penalize the countries without actually saying which point they would be penalized. It's a very confusing situation, and I expect that we'll see some tussling back and forth and perhaps even some court cases where people say, can Obama do this unilaterally without congressional approval? It's unclear at this point.
And a lot of this may depend on who the next president is and whether they'll stick with commitments that the president makes. How is climate change featuring, if at all, in the 2016 election?
Right. So on the Democratic side, you know, it is an issue that is of some importance. It, in fact, rates with terrorism. It's about the same percentage of Democrats who say terrorism is the top issue as they do say climate change is the top issue when it comes to their vote. So it shouldn't be surprising as we see the Democratic debates going forward. We should hear Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley talking about climate change a lot. On the Republican side, as I hinted out earlier, however, there really is no discussion here. Voters do not care. In fact, if you were to come and say that I support that, I believe climate change is a top issue, a top priority, in fact, could lose you votes in a Republican primary.
Staying with that Republican primary now, some changes in the polls. Ben Carson was up at the top or top two for a while there. A big slipping for him in some of the most recent national and I think Iowa polls, too.
Yeah, so if we look today, there was a Quinnipiac poll that had him dropping from a clear second place. And in fact, there were a few polls that had him in the top spot over Trump, but dropping from that first, second place to now being in a fight for second or third or fourth, depending on where exactly he falls with Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. He was only at 16% in the Quinnipiac poll that was out today. He had been previously in the low to mid 20s. But it's not just that he's falling in the horse race. His favorability ratings are also dropping. He used to be the most liked candidate in the field. Now that distinction belongs to Marco Rubio, as Carson's favorability ratings have dropped significantly. And in Iowa as well, where he was leading, and now it seems that Ted Cruz is in fact the main challenger with Donald Trump.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538 about the top national news stories in the world of politics. So Ben Carson fitting a pattern we've seen in past elections. Somebody emerges on the Republican side. They're in the limelight. They do well in the polls. Then they fade. It's happened to a lot of people. Donald Trump stayed at the top of the polls, keeps staying at the top of the polls. He's defying that gravity we've seen in past elections.
Every day that Donald Trump stays atop the polls, the heart muscles beat a little harder among analysts like myself, who expected that Trump by this point would probably be back on the television gravy train of doing some reality television show. But he has stayed on top. Now, he hasn't really risen very much. He sort of stayed in the mid-20s. His numbers have been fairly stable everywhere. But it's fairly clear at this point that we shouldn't expect the next poll, national poll, to come out, or even the one after that, to show Trump falling. We'll see, though, if he can actually stay on top as votes actually get cast in Iowa and New Hampshire. That's going to be key. If he can win Iowa, all bets are off, and you know what? We may be eating big humble pie if he can win in Iowa, but that's far, far away at this point.
And this is after a week of media coverage of some unusual Trump news, negative comments about Muslims. People have challenged the truth of a lot of his comments on that issue, apparently making fun of a handicapped reporter. There's been a lot of Trump stories that for a mainstream establishment candidate would be poison, and yet he's staying up at the top of the polls.
You know, I would say two things. One, what's remarkable about Trump is that he doesn't apologize for anything. You know, if a mainstream establishment candidate said what Trump said, he'd apologize immediately, and I think people would recognize, his supporters would recognize, ooh, he said something that's bad, wrong, we don't like that. But Trump doesn't apologize at all. He gives no reason for his supporters to believe that he said anything wrong. And in fact, you could take some lessons from some things outside of politics. You could look at sports. You could look at something like Lance Armstrong, where his favorable ratings among cycling fans stayed relatively high even when all the allegations came out that he was doping. But it wasn't until he admitted he was doping that his favorability ratings dropped. So for Trump, the mere fact that he's not admitting anything, saying that he's done anything wrong, may be the thing that's keeping him up in top right now.
Quick look at another candidate, Chris Christie, lurking toward the bottom of the top pack of 10 or so a lot of the times. Some good news for him in the second state, New Hampshire, in the primary.
No one has spent more time visiting the state of New Hampshire than Chris Christie. And it seems that it's maybe paying off. He got the endorsement of the New Hampshire Union Leader, which is the largest newspaper in that state. And historically, that endorsement has come with an increase in support in the polls. That didn't happen last time with Newt Gingrich. But this is just the latest sign of some momentum for him in that state. He's also gotten the endorsements of some key people on the ground there. So we'll see if he's able to actually, you know, take that support as well as rising favorabilities in the polls and actually start getting better poll numbers in the horse race and the top line numbers against Trump. But right now he's still only polling at 5%. But let's see where he is in a week or two. If there's one person at this point to keep an eye on New Hampshire, it's Christie.
Turning back to Congress, about 9 days now till the federal government runs out of money in some technical sense. What would Congress have to do in the next week or so to prevent that happening?
Well, I mean, they'd essentially have to sign an omnibus or they'd have to sign some sort of stopgap measure. It does not seem, however, that there will be any sort of shutdown. Even if, you know, the Republicans offered their first sort of omnibus package and Democrats said this wasn't serious, they're going to get together, they're going to talk. They're going to talk about different things that might be holding it up. For instance, there were a whole bunch of environmental add-ons to the bill that Democrats really, really didn't like. Republicans will probably either tone those down or get rid of them. And even if they can't come to an agreement within the next week or so, they're just going to pass some sort of stopgap measure. There's no talk of a shutdown at this time. Of course, we'll see where we are in a week. We've said this before. Oh, they won't shut it down, and then they did shut it down. But at this point, a shutdown looks considerably less likely than it has been in the past.
Another sticking point I've seen is restrictions on refugees, especially from Iraq and Syria, whether that should be in this funding thing or not. Is that something that's sort outable in Congress?
I think it's absolutely sort outable. At this point, you know, if you talk with Republicans, they'll say that maybe we were a little quick to jump and pass this what some might call an anti-refugee bill, or at least, you know, making it much more difficult for refugees from Syria and Iraq to get into the United States. They're thinking twice about that and looking at other ways in which they could protect against people coming into this country that might do some harm. So I don't think it will stand in the way. I think Republicans realize that there's no chance of that getting passed. So why fight for it when you can fight for something else, such as the visa waiver program, in which people are able to get in this country much more easily, and tightening those restrictions? That's probably a much better path forward to them, and they'll probably pursue that in the upcoming few days and weeks ahead.
We'll check in with you in precisely 1 week. Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics.
Well, the snow is starting to settle on the site of the former Badger Army ammunition plant near Baraboo. A group that calls itself the Badger Apple Corps is already thinking about spring and the apple trees that will be blooming then.
Our next guest is one of the Badger Apple Corps. Along with other scientists, he's working to identify the trees remaining on the former Badger Ammo site. These days, almost all the buildings are gone, and it's a scramble to locate the apple trees and tag them. Once they're found, the trick is figuring out what they are. Huge numbers of heirloom apple trees are now gone. The trees at this site could be rare and maybe even hardy breeds.
Kurt Miney joins us now. He's a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation and founding member of the Sauk Prairie Conservation Alliance. He wrote about the apple trees of the Badger Ammo Plant in the Wisconsin People and Ideas magazine. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, you're a member of the Badger Apple Corps. What is that?
Well, that's our fun name for an ad hoc group of friends and colleagues working in the Sauk Prairie area who have been interested in these historic apple trees at the old Badger Army ammunition plant.
And the pun is intentional.
The pun is intentional and almost unavoidable.
So when most of us think of the Badger Army ammunition plant, we don't think apple trees. Tell us a little bit about some of these trees that persist on the site of this old plant.
Sure. Well, most people are familiar with the landscape. If you've gone up Highway 12 to Devil's Lake or to Baraboo, you've passed by this big open landscape out there. And for those who've been around a while, you remember all the buildings that used to be out there when the plant was producing materials. Well, those buildings are gone. But what we sometimes forget is the layer of history before that, to build the plant in 1942, the federal government had to remove about 80 farm families from that landscape. So they moved them quickly in 3 months after Pearl Harbor. Those families had to be up and out. And they left behind not much. The farm buildings were removed. The barns and other farm buildings were gone. And all that was left of a lot of these old farmsteads are some foundations, a few rose bushes and lilac bushes, and it turns out some old apple trees, and that's what got us interested in this project.
So you might think old apple trees, what's so special about them? But it turns out there is a lot of mystery that surrounds the trees that are left there. What's so mysterious about them?
Well, what's mysterious is, first of all, how they survived, I guess, and how they continued to grow through a world war, subsequent conflicts, the transitions in the landscape, the changes in the economy, and all the things that have gone on since 1941, 42, and yet these trees are still there. But we don't know much about them. We didn't even know how many there were. We still don't know exactly how many there are, but we've begun to do some work to try to give some facts to this interesting situation.
And some of them may be, once you figure out what they are, it could be that some of them are quite rare, right?
Well, that's what we can hope for. We don't know yet what kind of varieties we have. There's a lot of interest right these days in preserving agricultural biodiversity, and particularly apples. There's a lot of interest in apples from the cider industry, you know, the cider brewing industry, and from people who are just interested in protecting what we're losing, and that is a lot of the diversity of our crops and around the world. And here's a little example of it right in our own backyard that we can really focus on.
And your job right now, among other jobs, is to find these trees,
right,
to tag them. And you say this is not so easy because a lot of them have gone, as you say, feral.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you kind of have to crawl through the underbrush just to find these things. What is that process like?
Well, the process really is, so we're learning as we go along. But apple trees bloom, of course, in the spring, usually within a few days around Mother's Day in May. And that's the best time to see them because the bright white flowers are out there. And in this landscape, which is being encroached upon by invasive shrubs and other plants, they can be hard to pick out in some areas. So you have to go out there when they're in bloom. to find them. And then, yeah, some of them are kind of engulfed in vegetation, and we have to have to crawl through a lot of brambles to get to them. But the key is just to find out how many there are, what shape they're in, and begin this process of trying to learn more about what they are and if we do have anything special.
And it sounds as though you've enlisted the help of Dan Bussey from Seed Savers to help you crack the mystery on these trees. How is he going about it?
Well, Dan, he's a treasure. He's a native kid of Edgerton, just outside Madison here, and he's made a passionate commitment to protecting the diversity of apples, not only here in the Midwest, but nationwide. And he's the chief orchardist over at Seed Savers, which is this wonderful little nonprofit over in Decorah, Iowa, that really exists to protect and sustain our diversity in our agricultural crops. And just recently, they've rehabilitated their orchard over there. And Dan took over that project, but he knew about Badger because he's a Wisconsin guy. And when he heard about this project, he got all excited because he knew that Sauk County in particular was a historic center for apple growing back in the late 1800s. So he's been very interested. He came out with us a few times, and in fact, I just saw him yesterday over in Iowa, and he's all eager to help us with the next steps of this project, too.
We're talking right now with Kurt Miney, senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation and a founding member of the Sauk Prairie Conservation Alliance, talking about the effort to identify and locate some possibly antique breeds of apple trees on the former site of the Badger Army Ammunition Plant. And so one question, I guess, that's lingering now is whether or not these apples will be safe to eat, because over the years the soil has been contaminated. There has been some work to clear it to make it safe again. But what do we know about how safe these apples might be to eat?
Right. That's a question we started with, actually. We wanted to know this. Many people are aware that the production years at the plant did result in a lot of environmental contamination. So we were concerned about this. And it is a problem, but it's also an opportunity to learn. Because there's actually, it turns out, not much research on this question. And as people become more interested in different forms of agriculture and bringing fruit trees and woody plant material back into the farm operations, and especially in urban areas where there's a lot more interest in growing food in urban settings, sometimes old brownfields, contaminated sites, this is actually an opportunity to fill in a little gap in knowledge here about how fruit trees do perhaps can get contaminated. The good news is that what research has been done seems to show that fruit trees are way at the end of the potential risk spectrum. Things like annual leafy vegetables and so forth, lettuce and vegetables are a lot more susceptible to that kind of uptake. But we do hope to do some analysis of the fruits and see what we can learn that can be applied elsewhere.
Have you been on the site when they're in bloom yet, or has that effort, has it not timed out that way yet?
Well, last two springs, around Mother's Day, we have gone out to look for these trees, and then we'll keep an eye on them, and then back in the fall, come and try to collect some of these fruits and see what we got. And it's an adventure because you're learning every time you're out there.
What do we know about the future of these apple trees and also the way that relates to the future of this particular land?
Yeah, well, a lot of these trees have been sort of abandoned for decades in some cases. But they are tough survivors, and it's really impressive. It's inspirational in a way to see how these trees have continued, despite being completely uncared for, to produce delicious fruit. It's also a chance, though, Badger, of course, isn't isolated. It's part of a larger Sauk County and Wisconsin landscape, and the same situation applies everywhere. All over the state, all over the country, we have seen this loss of diversity in apples and this sort of abandonment of what our great grandfathers and grandmothers gave us. And so it's a chance to bring some attention to a larger issue that goes beyond the boundaries of the Badger ammo plant.
Now, you're a scientist, but listening to you talk, you sound as though you've gotten a little attached to these trees.
Well, you know, those of us who do conservation work, we try to be totally objective, of course, and scientific about it. No, it's not only the trees themselves, though. It's these stories that they carry with them. It's the stories of the people and of the places that we go to. And Badger is layered in rich history, human history and natural history. And for me, it's an important way of reconnecting the current landscape to that history that can easily be forgotten. Even World War II is fading from memory now. This place transformed the state of Wisconsin, and it changed tremendously the life in our community in Sauk Prairie. A lot of those families are still around, even though they had to be removed from their farms. They still live in the Sauk Prairie area, and many of them are good friends of mine. And so this is a chance for them to reconnect, too, with a bit of their history. And that's kind of the ultimate dream of this project is Badger, when it was built in 1942, these families had to be removed quickly. They had to sacrifice, as did the whole country. And their sacrifice has never really been honored. And ultimately, my and our dream is to maybe have an orchard that we can recreate out of these trees that will honor that history and that sacrifice and reconnect people to their history, but also propel it forward.
Well, I wish you luck with that. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
Kurt Miney is a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, founding member of the Sauk Prairie Conservation Alliance. He joined us to talk about the apple trees at the former Badger Ammo Plant. The site is currently co-managed by the Ho-Chunk Nation, the state of Wisconsin, and the USDA Dairy Forage Research Center.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Just about a month ago, Kraft Heinz announced that it would be shuttering its Oscar Mayer plant in Madison, as well as a few other facilities around the country. State and local officials said they hadn't known about the plant closing.
The decision will cost Wisconsin nearly 1,000 jobs at the plant, which makes a variety of processed meats and also served as the company's headquarters.
Jennifer Reingold joins us now. She's a senior editor at Fortune and co-chair of Fortune's Most Powerful Women Summit. She wrote the recent article, Investors Win, Workers Lose as Oscar Mayer plant, as Oscar Mayer closes iconic plant. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you say in your article that it's hardly news that yet another old American factory is closing down. So given that, why did Fortune decide to cover the Oscar Mayer closing in Madison?
It's kind of an iconic thing. First of all, everyone remembers the old days of the Oscar Mayer Wiener advertisements. They've seen the Wienermobile travel around. And, you know, what's more American than hot dogs, frankly? So there's an imagery to this that I think was very interesting. And I went out to Madison to really explore what this meant for the community, because I think we read, especially those of us who live in bigger cities, read all the time about these kinds of plants closing, but you never often see or share what's really happening to the people on the ground.
Right. You were here in Wisconsin. You talked to workers. You hung out at the bar that was a favorite with Oscar Mayer workers. What kinds of things did people tell you?
Well, I was in Wiggy's, which is the local hangout. It's actually almost right on the grounds of the plant itself. And, you know, everyone there at lunchtime was a retiree, basically, and people around the table had put in, you know, 35 years, 36 years, 18 years. And, you know, many of them are retired. They don't work there any longer, but they all know people that do or have relatives that do, and they're really sad. I mean, this is part of what happens in business, but when it happens to you, it's different.
Well, and you met people who were third-generation workers at Oscar Mayer. Is that typical when these sort of big anchor plants close?
It is typical, or I should say it used to be typical. I mean, I think the idea of there being third-generation workers at any company is probably pretty unusual these days. But the transitions and the closing also happen all the time. I think what's interesting here, though, is it's not just that a plant is closing. It's that this brand is owned by a larger company, Kraft. Oscar Mayer is owned by Kraft. And then Kraft, in turn, is now part of Kraft Heinz, which in turn is owned primarily by a Brazilian company called 3G and Warren Buffett. So if you sort of go all the way up the chain here, there are a very small group of investors who are controlling some of the biggest food brands in America.
Right, and when this merger happened, it sounded as though a lot of people, the workers especially, said, well, yeah, once that happened, the writing was on the wall. Why is it that everybody assumed the plant would close after that merger happened?
Well, 3G has a real a method behind their work, and they put 7,800 people out of work in Heinz in order to cut costs and to be more efficient. So when Heinz bought Kraft, it seemed very logical that this was going to happen again. Now, another interesting element about this particular plant is that while the Madison plant is closing, there's an Iowa plant that is also closing, but Kraft Heinz has agreed to open a newer, smaller plant in Iowa near the old plant. Iowa is paying about $15 million to incentivize Kraft Heinz to move there. And the plant is going to employ about a third the number of people that were in the other plant beforehand. So what I found fascinating is that Madison is not doing, or Wisconsin did not do this, but Iowa decided that they would pay something like $32,000 per worker to move the new factory there, even though they're going to lose more jobs than they're going to gain. And I just thought to myself, this seems crazy. I mean, this is probably similar to some of the salaries that are being earned by these workers in these plants, and the state is paying the company almost a form of corporate blackmail. It seems crazy to me.
Right. So what was the thinking behind incentivizing the company to open a smaller plant in Iowa when this is ultimately going to be a net job loss?
Well, the thinking is basically that if you don't do it, they're going to go somewhere else, and so you lose all the jobs. So they don't really, and I spoke to the director of community planning for the city of Davenport, and he basically said, look, this is how it's done in America these days. Everyone does this, and if you don't do it, then the jobs will move somewhere else. So at least we're saving some.
And so what does that say to you as someone who reports on this kind of thing about the state of industry and manufacturing in America?
What it says to me is that, of course, there are more efficient ways to do things. There always are. But in a situation like this, and by the way, I would also like to add that I had heard from several people that this plant was very, very old, and that it wasn't exactly a surprise that despite its history and so forth, that it was not the most efficient plant. But having said that, I think the money made by corporations used to be shared between the investors and the people who worked there. And now I feel that the balance has really shifted, so the money really accrues to the investors only. This has happened over a long, long period of time, but to me the closing of this particular plant felt like a really stark example of that.
We're talking right now with Jennifer Reingold of Fortune Magazine, talking about the closing of Oscar Mayer's plant in Madison. And we were talking a moment ago about this company, 3G, a Brazilian company that was involved with Heinz and thereby with Oscar Mayer. And they're also involved in another recent merger that affects Wisconsin, the joining of the beer giants AB InBev and SAB Miller. So does that merger have any similarities to how the Oscar Mayer situation is playing out?
I can only look at what they have done in the past because they are extremely consistent about how they operate. They have operated almost exactly the same way with every acquisition they've done, and there have been massive, massive cuts. So I would strongly expect there to be more job cuts anywhere where there can be any sort of overlap. And I would also expect there to be they run a very, very, very lean operation, which is very admirable in some ways. I mean, these guys don't take they work on kind of blank desks. They don't spend money on copy paper. They're extremely frugal. So there's not just like fat cats jetting around all over the place, although they are very, very wealthy. But I would expect to see much more Spartan working conditions for the people that continue to work there, and also significant job losses.
Now, looking a little bit here at the political context, one of the hallmarks of Governor Scott Walker's tenure as governor of Wisconsin and also his short-lived run for president has been what he calls taking on labor unions, and his catchphrase, Wisconsin is open for business. As you talk to people surrounding this Oscar Mayer plan closure, what's the perception of how Governor Walker's policies are playing out for corporations and smaller businesses, and Oscar Mayer in this case?
Well, I should add that most of the people that I spoke to who were working at the plant were, in fact, union members. So I think before this news came out, they were not very in favor of what Governor Walker has been doing. But there were some sarcastic comments, oh, yeah, open for business, right. And then there was, of course, a debate as to whether or not it is appropriate to be incentivizing companies to stay when they threaten to move. I mean, you can see two sides of that, right? You can see that you know, you won't sort of put up with that kind of corporate blackmail. But on the other hand, if the jobs leave, the jobs leave. And if that's the way it's done, some people wondered whether Governor Walker had tried, in fact, to keep the plant.
We'll take a caller now. We have Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you very much. You know, as a conservative, I agree a lot with some of the rhetoric that Scott Walker did, but in practice, it seemed like it was all about his ambition to become president, and that once he started his run for president, he forgot all about Wisconsin. So So my question was, could Scott Walker have prevented any loss of jobs for the Wisconsin people he was elected by to serve? I'm very, very upset with Scott Walker, and this is an example of how he did things, that he basically left the Wisconsin when he decided to run for president. Thank
you. All right, Charlie, thank you for that call. And Jennifer, you can look at Wisconsin, but also, are you seeing any sort of through lines with other governors, any sort of common threads in plant closures like this?
Well, again, I think the incentivization question is huge. My colleague Peter Elkind at Fortune did an incredible story about Tesla, and Tesla was going to open a new plant, and they basically put themselves out for bidding. You know, who will pay us the most to locate our plant where? And it's just incredible. It is incredible what the states did and what they did. And it makes sense if you think about it one way, which is that, you know, you want the jobs there, you want the glow of a new factory being in some place like this. But if you actually do the math on the amount of money that's spent per worker and the likelihood that they're going to stay, it doesn't work out.
Is that what you're seeing across the country, that when there is this incentivization to keep companies, that it doesn't ultimately end up making an economic difference again?
Well, it's really hard to know, because this has really happened and become much more prevalent over the past, you know, decade, and it's accelerated. But in many cases, the companies are not required to stay. I mean, they're required to locate there at the moment or keep X jobs there for X period of time, but after that, they don't have to. So it is not clear. It's similar in some ways to the way that sports stadiums have been financed by cities and states. And those, by the way, have been proven to very rarely work out.
We'll continue our discussion about the closing of Madison's Oscar Mayer plant with Jennifer Reingold of Fortune magazine in just a minute. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Were you directly or indirectly impacted by the announcement of the closing of the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison? And what about maybe the GM plant closing in Janesville or other plant closings around the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our discussion now with Jennifer Reingold of Fortune magazine, looking at the Oscar Mayer plant closing in Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that has an impact on you? Or if you're in another community, has your town, your city lost a major factory? What's been the impact there? How is your community recovering from that moving forward? Should local state governments offer incentives to keep businesses in the area? Or should the focus be on training, retraining workers supporting new ventures? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Jacob on the line in Burlington. Jacob, hi.
Hi. My comment is that this is the free market run amok. It is capitalism run amok. And normally we have some semblance of government to raise the ethical questions. And the free market has no ethics. And the problem in my mind is that no one has the strength, and Walker is certainly showing this, or the will to want to challenge the free market system and balance the ethics of it.
Thank you for the call, Jacob. And Jennifer, is this a conversation that you see happening across the country? Are people thinking about the free market and what it's doing right now?
To me, the question is not whether it's the free market or not the free market. It's sort of where does the money end up? And I just want to point out one thing about the closing of this plant. By the way, this plant was one of seven plants that were closed across the country. That announcement was made at the same time. So it wasn't just this particular plant with this number of jobs. But, you know, on the day after the announcement was made about the closings, Kraft Heinz announced it was raising its dividend by 4.5%. So that means if you're a stockholder, which, you know, I know some of the workers may well be, that's good. You get 4.5% more guaranteed, basically. But really, the investors who are primarily the large private equity firm 3G and Warren Buffett are the ones who are making a direct profit from that raising of the dividend. And so I think, to Jacob's question, that's where the confusion and where things seem to have really gone amok, which is Does all the money that corporations make accrue to the investors? Is that right, or should it also accrue to the stakeholders as well as the shareholders?
Is this another way of getting at income inequality?
I think it is. I think that income inequality is a, you know, obviously a very big issue, and I also think that business is about efficiency. So the two things, it is not wrong for a company to close a plant that is not efficient, if in fact it is not efficient. It is not wrong that a company has to cut costs and operate better. But at what point is there more concern with the investor base than anything else? And what are, does a corporation have any other purpose besides to return money to investors?
And Jennifer, looking at the workers, again, you were here in Madison. What do we know based on other scenarios around the country? What do we know about what might happen with these workers and also the communities at large, the neighborhoods that surround these plants?
Well, this is kind of the sad, you know, spreading element of these things, which is that it's never just the jobs that are affected. It's the community. You know, I talked to the United Way of Dane County, and, you know, I think the Oscar Mayer plants were potentially the greatest single contributors to the United Way of, and the 2.2% of the contributions came directly from Oscar Mayer workers. I have to imagine that would be affected. Real estate values, if they don't find a buyer for this plant, it's possible they may, but they may just sit there empty. If that happens, nobody wants to live around that anymore. It becomes a blight on the neighborhood. You know, the retirees have to deal with what happens as well, because what has been promised to retirees by companies when they close a plant does not always hold up. And so there's like a ripple effect here.
When you said a possible buyer, what kind of buyer might be interested in it? As you said, an older plant and a large one at that.
I have been told that there are some organizations out there that might be able to use the space. I was not given any particular names. I don't know for sure. But I think that, I mean, the plant is 100 years old. I think that whatever would happen, there would have to be a lot of work done to make it operational for something else.
We're going to go back to our callers now and take one from Mary in Brookfield. Mary, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Jennifer. I have just a question. Someone mentioned free capital system or whatever, the free market system and capitalism. My question is, I mean, we've got this throughout the nation, obviously. And when you just take a look at, let's just say Minnesota, for example, why is Minnesota doing so much better than is Wisconsin? Or why is Wisconsin doing so much worse than is Minnesota? I mean, aren't we now like 49th in attracting jobs? Or, you know, I don't even know what the number stands for. But I know that we're losing jobs hand over fist. What does the government have to do with this, with this current regime that we have?
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. And can we do a little survey of Wisconsin and other states nearby and take a look at how Wisconsin is doing economically comparatively, what other states like Iowa in this instance might be doing differently?
Well, I think that I don't live in Wisconsin, so I can't speak specifically to, you know, what incentives are being offered or what aren't. But I can say that it also depends on what kinds of jobs Wisconsin has been known for. I mean, I actually come from Western New York, which was a big, you know, blue collar kind of a car building place. And when in Buffalo, the GM plants closed down in the 70s and 80s, that part of the country really is only now beginning to recover. It's incredible. I mean, now these are cosmic shifts that affect more than, you know, one town. I mean, the whole labor market has changed so dramatically that it's not independent. You know, it's not specific to Wisconsin. But I can't answer specifically that question. But I would just say it is, in fact, part of the responsibility of the government to make businesses feel welcome in their state.
We're talking with Jennifer Reingold right now from Fortune Magazine about the closing of the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison. We're going to go next to Dan in Appleton. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
You know, I take issue with one of the comments the earlier caller meant regarding the free market run amok. And at the end of the day, does the government have a role in regulating the free market? No, the government really has a role in getting out of the way, allowing the free market to work. What does that mean? Well, if people truly do want to do backdoor deals and lobby for industry to come to the state, the best advertisement is low taxes, freedom to work. And again, at the end of the day, it's not like Governor Walker in the state of Wisconsin does not have recourse. Again, when it comes to building automobiles, for example, could I say, hey, you know, if Ford wants to leave, maybe we will consider using Chevy. Maybe we will consider using Chrysler.
And we're going to leave it there, Dan, just to make sure we have time for a response. Jennifer, what do you say to that?
I think he's right. I mean, the free market does still function, and if people don't, by the way, the other thing we haven't talked about with the Oscar Mayer plan is the fact that people are not eating as much of their products as they did. I mean, there's been a real shift to healthier kinds of food, and hot dogs and processed meats and so forth are actually not doing as well as they were a few years ago. So that's the market speaking. I mean, if people don't want the product, then it makes sense that there would be fewer places to make it. But having said that, I think there's a broader question about what the role is of government. Government and business do, in fact, have to work together and do work together, whatever you think about the free market or you don't. And it is my sense that, at least in this case, there was not a whole lot of interaction between the government and between the company.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That is Jennifer Reingold, senior editor at Fortune magazine. She wrote the recent article called Investors Win, Workers Lose as Oscar Mayer Closes Iconic Plant. It's linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
We here at Central Time have gotten hooked over the years on the annual announcement of the color of the upcoming year from the company Pantone. Not sure why, but at least I'm always really curious about it.
Well, the company surveys designers and manufacturers of clothing and home decorations to see what the big color trends of the year are going to be. And the previous winning color was Marsala, kind of a warm, spicy color. Mm-hmm. Before that, Radiant Orchid, purple color.
Yeah.
And the winner for 2016, actually two winners actually this year. Rose Quartz and one called Serenity. They're supposed to be used alone or as a pair.
Rose Quartz is in the neighborhood of what I would call pinkish, and Serenity is a mellow light blue, maybe a little pastel-y.
Yeah, I would call them both pastel, and I would say that they're both baby blue is, I think, what that one is, and I think the other is, I don't know, is there a baby pink?
Baby pink, well, yeah, and that's what I thought, too, and I think that's what every single person who looks at it is going to think, except the people at Pantone who said, no, these are not the baby colors. These are, you know, these are exciting, new, dynamic, bold
right,
colors.
And they did have a picture of a man's dress shirt in baby blue with this sort of pinkish baby pink tie.
Right.
They didn't look terrible.
Didn't look bad.
Are we
going to
see you wearing
bad.
That, Rob?
Yeah, as I do every year this time, I'm going to burn my entire clothing collection by only clothes in this approved color for the coming year.
Baby pink
new
black?
I'm wearing gray and blue this year. I'm not wearing, Marsala? Sorry.
We'll give it a try. I don't know. I'm skeptical of these colors, but, you know.
We'll see. We'll see if we see them everywhere.